Yeah, certainly my background wasn't in getting presentations set up, because I've floundered. But thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. Like Vinny said, I'm the co-founder and chief growth officer of PadSplit. We're a technology startup based in Atlanta, and I'm excited to be here. But if we could, sorry, this is quite loud. Actually, I don't really even need a mic. I'm really loud. My can you hear me? My mother's from South Jersey, so really, I'm kind of okay, perfect. It's could be a little overpowering, you know. It's one of those, the Luciano side, you know, really kind of projects. So we'll try and tone it down. Thank you. So I'm here today to talk to you about PadSplit and our company. And we've got a booth set up, and we've got a lot of time this weekend to sort of talk about it more intimately, but wanted to give everyone a quick overview. I'll be brief, would love questions kind of throughout or at the end. But before we get started, I'd like for everyone to just kind of close your eyes for a minute and imagine someone who is working full-time, okay, but is functionally homeless. Okay, what does that mean? What do such people do? Right? In many cities, such as this one, or Atlanta, or Houston, or many cities we're in, they commute from further and further away. They drive till they qualify, right? Until they can afford the rent, clog up all the highways, right? Sometimes they crash at a friend's house, sleep in their car, spending time on the West Coast, see a lot of people doing that. I hope you meet Mariah. She's a writer at a church in Atlanta. She makes about $20,000 a year. Right, she's working, she's full-time. Now, I heard a rumor there may be some real estate investors in the crowd. You're thinking, okay, well, I require three times rent as income for someone to qualify. And again, I am a former Marine, so don't make me do math in public, but $20,000, what do you qualify for? It's like $600. So where she lives in Atlanta, feel free to break out your phones and check for rentals for $600 that don't exist. You know, a one-bedroom classy apartment, good luck finding anything for under $1,000. And that's true in almost every metro area in the country. So what did she do? She was sleeping on a friend's couch, okay, until she found us. And so for the past 2 years, she's been renting a room with PadSplit, and she's able to work more hours because she's in the city, she's closer to work, she has one easy bill. And she's also not alone, right? She's part of the largest rental group in the United States. One of over 14 million Americans who are singles who make under $35,000 a year. So it's not a small market. It's not a niche market. It's an enormous market. So, okay, great, you know, she needs a place. How do we do it? So this is what PadSplit does at its core. We work with property owners such as you to help capture and monetize underutilized space. So again, I am a Marine, that's a lot of big words. What does that actually mean? We take, with investors, what are typically single-family homes, but oftentimes ones that aren't really optimized for traditional rentals, right? They're a little bit bigger, you know, they're maybe a little bit harder to manage. And one of our early insights was, for single-family rentals, you get paid for the first bedroom, get a little bit for the second, maybe a touch for the third. Fourth bedroom's a liability, right? It's extra space. It makes your room turn, or your property turns more expensive. You don't really get paid for it. However, for that specific type of rental, that kind of larger property, when your revenue-generating units are the bedroom, you want those extra bedrooms. That's income. It's the way, same way you would think about an apartment complex, where every apartment is revenue-generating. So again, that traditional single-family rental that maybe rents for $1,700, yeah, you're doing that, you're doing well, you're paying maintenance, you're paying a property manager, maybe you're clearing $1,400, then you'll pay taxes and insurance. That's a business, you know, you're doing well. But for anyone who's buying today and trying to add to your portfolio with where asset prices are right now, you know, people are buying at four caps in single family, right? That same house that, again, before you weren't getting paid for the living room, dining room, basement, anything like that, oftentimes can be converted into bedrooms, and when that happens, again, $600, $700 per bedroom, all of a sudden you're generating two, three times as much gross rent for the exact same property. And we work with investors to show you how. So how does it work? We are a two-sided marketplace. I think kind of like Airbnb, but instead of being fractional in terms of occupancy, one short-term rental followed by another rental followed by another, we're fractional in terms of space, right? It's a room rental business. A lot of people come up to me all the time and say, oh, you know, room rentals. I talk to my kids, you know, it seems like a young person thing. They'll get it. Like kids share. I'm like, no, talk to your grandmother, right? Because this is how people used to live in the United States. If you go back to really pre-70s, if you were a single factory worker type of in the city, you weren't getting your own apartment. It didn't work. You boarded. That was what people did. You know, you watch It's a Wonderful Life. It was Ma Bailey's boarding house. This is what people did. What is unique and strange about our culture today is this idea that someone who's getting their start or someone who's, you know, frankly, just not making, they're not a high-income person and they're single, they're going to live on their own. In Atlanta, where I live, to create a new apartment, you require 760 square feet and a parking spot. The parking spot in the city costs you $40,000 to set up. 760 square feet is a lot of space. I certainly don't have 760 square feet in my house. I have six people in my house. That's just because I have a bunch of kids and so on. But everyone shares space. I share space today to cut down my costs. Unfortunately, I'm the only one paying the mortgage. That's a different discussion. But this is what people do, right? So we do the same thing, and we make it accessible for singles everywhere, right? So again, think at its core, two-sided marketplace. So on one side, there's the host. They list a property on a platform. What we do for them is we generate leads, do all the screening, do background check, credit check, income verification, employment verification. We do all the people management. So Johnny ate my peanut butter, Sally looked at me funny, that comes to our 24/7 call center, so landlords don't have to take it. We do all the collections work. So we do weekly billing for everybody. So again, when you think about, okay, I don't want to manage six tenants in a house paying weekly, that might be 30 payments in a week, or in a month, excuse me. We bring it all together, one payment to the landlord, makes it easy for your lender, makes it easy for your accountant. And of course, we've been doing this for 10 years. So some of the things that you maybe haven't really thought hard about as a landlord, you know, how do you drive down utility costs? I've never really thought about it because I've never paid the utility bills in my rentals. We will go deep in the weeds with you and talk about 1.25 gallon per minute shower heads that are available on Amazon today. They're $9. You know, go do it. That is the thing that we do all day, every day. And that is what our team is kind of designed to help you with. And on the other side of the marketplace, the resident-facing side, they come to our website, they find and book rooms, they rate each other, they rate maintenance tickets, they rate the property. You know, ratings are very important for the marketplace and keeping it accountable. They pay one easy bill, right? So, you know, and I say this as a landlord, landlords are kind of lazy and we aren't that inventive, right? We bill on the first because it's easy for collections, your lenders like it, it's the way we've always done it. But it's not great for renters, it's not very customer focused, right? So, you know who's really smart? Rent-A-Center. They bill at the end of the month because they know people pay bills sequentially, right? They know someone gets a bill in the mail, they say, oh, well, I don't want to lose my sofa, so I'll pay this bill. Rent comes on first. I'm like, well, I don't have any money. You know, that sofa is getting put out on the street. It's not good, but that's the way that people act. So we bill weekly, and we've built the technology to allow residents to set their bill date whenever works for them. So if they get paid on a Wednesday, they want to pay on a Wednesday, that's fine because we want to always be on top of it. We want to be the first bill paid. And again, because everything's bundled into one, it's much easier for people to say, hey, I got to pay my PadSplit bill. They also always pay their cell phone bill. You know, we don't want to be a cell phone business either, but making it as simple as possible, as customer focused as possible, to make it as easy as possible for people to pay every time, which is why we underwrite tenants who make less than anyone else in the country and still have a 97% collections rate. Of course, what else we do for them is we're ensuring the quality of the units and experience. You know, we're sticklers for that stuff. We're screening all their roommates. If you're in a co-living situation, you're happy that everyone's being background checked. And, of course, we provide the platform for everyone to use. And we're the only players in the workforce side of the co-living marketplace. Co-living is sort of a buzzword. You know, there's tech bros with blazers and T-shirts who come and talk about it with sort of these things, you know. And on that side, it's probably a fine business. You know, it's just not the one we're in, right? So you probably you've heard of Common or Ollie or some of these. Average income is about $90,000 for their customers. We're just not in that business. Ours is workforce housing. It's for the people who live and work in our communities, security guards, people working fast food, hospitality, manufacturing, distribution centers, drivers. We also think it's the biggest unmet need in the market, and we're the only player there. So for those of you who love conceptual stuff, want to talk about Mariah and so on, you can just sort of like cool down. I'm going to talk, for those who need to talk about the numbers, let's do it right now. Just, you know, bear with me. We're going to drag through it quickly though. So again, people do this because they generate higher yields. We are a yield generating machine for investors. That is what we do. Our conviction is that if you care about solving the affordable housing crisis, the problem is affordable housing doesn't generate better yields, so people don't do it. But if you can generate above market yields, then you don't have a problem, because then you're tapping into the capital, intellect, energy, creativity of the private investor. So for us, if the investor is generating above market yields, if they're having good outcomes, we grow, which is good for us, but we're solving the problem. And if we don't do that, there's no business to be had. So we are hyper-focused on investor outcomes. So again, think about that traditional rental. Maybe you're renting it out for $1,700. You think you're doing okay. You're paying some maintenance, paying your property manager 10%. And you're clearing, you know, $1,400. You're doing okay, right? That's fine. Well, again, that same house for, you know, kind of very minimal furnishings and so on, you know, we're generally about $670 a month on average, but, you know, let's be conservative. Let's make it net of vacancy and collections and so on. Six times 600 is about $3,600 a month. That's the big secret, right? A lot more revenue, right? That's where it all kind of flows from. So, yes, you know, maybe you have a touch more maintenance because there's more people. You've got pad splits fee, right? I got all those kids. You know, they got to eat, so, you know, that's very important. Paying your property manager, that's, you know, they're maybe making more. They're happy. You're paying utilities on the property. So your expenses are higher, but people do it because their NOI is significantly higher. That is why people work with us. I can also share these slides with you. You know, it's not a secret. So people say, okay, well, great, you know, but I have to invest more up front. Sure, you know, you got to furnish it. It's the way that people think about Airbnbs, right? Sure, you got to put in a little more work up front. But again, people do it because higher return on cost, right? And the good news is today, if you can earn 5% on traditional rental, you're doing pretty well unlevered. That's about as good as folks can do, I think, in general. We're generally north of 10% unlevered. So with interest rates where there are, oftentimes kind of high 20s, 30s in kind of annualized return, even including that kind of upfront investment. So let's look at some actual properties. And these are all actual pad splits. So this is a real property in Decatur, Georgia, so kind of just outside the city. The one caveat that I will offer for all these is that these case studies are all stabilized. We wanted to show ones that have been on our platform for 2+ years to show kind of all actuals. Unfortunately, for anyone who's been buying properties over the past 2 years, you've noticed that they've appreciated like crazy. So no, you cannot buy this property for $128,000 today. Those deals are all gone. We don't have a time machine. So anyway, with that caveat there, this is from one of our investors. Again, we don't own this property. It's owned by an investor. He's a local real estate agent in Atlanta who works with us. He bought a house for $128,000, you know, sort of a late 60s split level, of which there's thousands and thousands around where we live. It's a pretty big house, 2,100 square feet. You know, it's got that kind of the basement. He finished up the basement, turned into a 7-bedroom house. Very standard for us. We're generally around 7-8 bedrooms per property. He put in a lot of work into it, about $40,000, as he had to finish out the basement, fix it up. So he's all in for about $170,000. Previously been a rental for just under $1,400. Well, again, through the pandemic, through lease up, he's been collecting over $4,000 a month. That's an actual, right? That's over the course of multiple years. Okay, pays pad split. Again, that's hyper important. Utility bills, all there, maintenance. I'll make this all available. You know, you have to copy it down. So look, he has expenses on it, right? He's paying his property manager 8%. His property manager went from making $140 a month to making $325. Property manager's excited, right? He's clearing over $2,600 a month on a property that he's all in for under $200,000. Remember that 1% rule that people would talk about and never really realized? We're oftentimes there today. So again, he's about 10% unlevered return, IRR up in the 20s. And that's before we factor in the fact that this has probably appreciated $50,000 in the meantime. So that had nothing to do with us, obviously. Crosstown, again, similar-ish property, but this is sort of the rinse and repeat that investors do. Different investors based in New York, so he's never even set foot on this property. Bought it for $140,000, put about $40,000 into it. It's now an 8-bedroom home. It was previously a Section 8 rental for $1,450 a month. Again, net of the pandemic, net of eviction moratoriums, net of all the craziness of the past 2 years, he's clearing over $4,400 a month. He's got his fees, he's got utilities, maintenance, you know, so on and so forth. Those are all actuals. And he's clearing close to $3,000 a month for a property that's in for $200,000. So 12% unlevered return, up in 20s for IRR. That's, again, before refinancing where it is today. This is why investors work with us. It's because the yields. So it's all about our hosts. They make the whole thing kind of work. On average, 129% increase in NOI, right? More than double the NOI. So if you're generally thinking, hey, I'm doing okay, I could probably be at about a 5 cap, for the right kind of asset, right kind of investor, right kind of market, generally north of 10, right? And then the way we know we're successful is that most of our hosts add more properties after the first one, right? Because they're trying to build on success, trying to build a portfolio. And our customers range from retail investors, where it's their first investment in real estate. This is maybe a side hustle, maybe it's their first foray, to big institutional funds, right? So, and everything in between. So we're agnostic there. So we've expanded into 8 markets just in this year alone. Okay, we're headquartered in Atlanta. It's where we got our start. This year we opened up DFW, Houston, New Orleans, Tampa, Indianapolis, Richmond, and Jacksonville. We are soon to be in Orlando, San Antonio, Charlotte, Columbus, Detroit. I can't even keep up with those slides because I'm slow with this stuff. I'm a Philly native myself. I grew up in Newtown Square. We will be in Philly quite soon. I was up walking properties in Philadelphia about a month ago. So, my mother's from Pennsville. You know, come on. We don't have South Jersey on the roadmap just yet, but I'm hoping to at some point. Jersey's a little bit tougher for various regulatory reasons, which we can have a much longer discussion about. I'm happy to. But
how about west and north, like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities?
So we will be in Minneapolis in 2022. We have projects in pipeline there. Yeah. Phoenix. Yep. Yes, ma'am. Pittsburgh. Yep. So essentially, I mean, our view is, there are markets where this is intrinsically difficult, San Francisco, New York City, both for regulatory and cost reasons. So, again, on the flip side is, this is already happening in New York. You know, we didn't invent this, you know, because, oh, great idea. It's not my idea. You know, this is something that happens in every metro area, in every city, in the world, really. What's different is New York and San Francisco are so expensive that it's happening extremely openly to a degree and at a size that we, you know, we really can't deal with. So, you know, you can rent a bunk bed in San Francisco for $1,000 a month in a room with, you know, 10 other people. We're not quite ready to get into that sort of business or one room, one person, you know, kind of thing. But so we're focused on kind of second tier cities, predominantly Midwest and Sunbelt is kind of the way to think about it. We'll likely be in the Northeast selectively, but for various reasons, some of the Northeast and California are tougher on the regulatory front for us to work through. And obviously we're vigilant on that. Ma'am. Done here, yep. Daryl, yeah.
And you're also working with Derek Dunbank
in Wisconsin, yes, ma'am.
So, are you planning on jumping the water and going into St. Petersburg at all?
St. Petersburg, Florida?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we have a property.
Daryl in Tampa, but are you guys going to jump
into
Texas?
Daryl and I are both LPs in that investment in Tampa. So we are not just colleagues, but yeah, we're business partners there. He is. So yes, we have a property opening in St. Petersburg in January. I will actually be in Tampa this coming Wednesday to tour it. So it's under contract. It's coming through. So aside, yes, we're also in Tampa. Yes, ma'am.
Even if you're not in the market, Michael and I are concerned if you have people who are remains or want to join in.
Great question. Absolutely. So, exactly. So the way to think about it is we are very intentional about how we enter markets. And the reason for that is that, again, good investor outcomes is our growth engine, right? If investors do well, they're, you know, we're all human. We do more of it, and we brag about it to our friends. That's good. For me, as a co-owner of PadSplit, if you do poorly, you do what humans do, and you do less of it, and you trash us to your friends, and I can't have that. They don't pay me enough for it. So the thing about this model is we want to go into a market with a plan to get to critical mass. So what that, and the reason for that is twofold. One is it's more customer value. So if you had one house, let's say, let's take Philadelphia as an example. You put one house in Philadelphia. If you're a renter coming in, you say, one location, really one kind of tight set of price points. You know, not a ton of value. Whereas if you see a couple, you say, oh, you know, I see one here. It's close to work. Oh, this one's maybe closer to family. It's kind of higher value. And then many of our residents are word of mouth, right, about 40%. So the more units we have in an area, the easier it is to fill up units because they're referring friends and colleagues and so on. So we want to have a network. The other piece of it is co-living's hard because people are hard, right? Not everyone's great to live with. So our customer service apparatus is designed to de-escalate interpersonal conflicts. So sometimes it's, hey, you know, Johnny, eat your peanut butter, give him a bad rating, or you just want to vent. But sometimes people just got to move, right? That's the release valve. So you want a network so that can happen seamlessly, because the flexibility of that is a big part of the value prop as well. So all that to say, if you want to be in a market that's not on our roadmap, we should have a conversation to do it together, you know, and collaborate to have a plan, because we want it to go well for you, because that's the only way it goes well for us. And in markets that we're already in or already in our pipeline, then it's much easier, because we can say, yeah, great, perfect. So yes, you just got to have a call about it. Easy, ma'am. Great question. So we are, the question was, do we do this in multifamily? We're predominantly single family, but we're about 10% in multifamily. So generally the mechanism that it looks like is folks will take, you know, typically older, kind of classy apartments and so on, but they'll take the bigger ones, right? So if you have a 200-unit complex, you know, kind of garden style, whatever, one and two bedrooms you leave is one and two bedrooms. That's the highest and best use. But maybe the three bedrooms, which oftentimes are the hardest to lease up, and you typically don't get much of a rent premium for them, take it maybe add a fourth bedroom, do it by the room, and it gives you kind of a bump there for a sliver of the complex. But yeah, we're in apartments today. Sir?
Would your rooms have all separate bedrooms?
No, sir. Some do have private baths. You charge more for it, right, cause it's higher value, but 90% are shared bath. Sir? Sir? Poorly. No, I'm just kidding. We actually sort of, I'll skip to it. I sort of like did a voiceover in terms of what we offer here. We are super involved in oftentimes pre-acquisition discussions with investors because it can be complex. If you're a traditional single family investor, you know, you care about the location, the bedrooms, you know, whatever. But you can do most of that on desktop. You know, you care which zip code it is, fine. Every day we are working with investors, looking at individual assets where they say, hey, what do you think about 123 Main Street? And, you know, we have a different framework for how we think about properties. So we'll say, oh, it's on a cul-de-sac. It'll be super tight for street parking. You should pass on it. Or, oh, it's a corner lot. You'll have lots of parking. Oh, and it's close to public transit, so on. So we work with investors through that whole process. Again, it's not a perfect one. You know, it's a question of mitigating risk, but, the answer is one. The biggest thing you can do is buying the right kind of asset, close to public transit, good parking. I see a house with parking around the back, and I'm like, oh, that's right on my alley. You know, that's like ideal. So we're very involved there, pointing people in the right direction. Obviously, it depends on how many bedrooms you have. So We have houses with 10 bedrooms. We have a 14-bedroom house in Atlanta. It's kind of a duplex, but it's right on a bus line. It's in an area with a lot of student housing. People are used to everyone parking on the street. It's no big deal. Other neighborhoods, you wouldn't nearly have that kind of flexibility. So there's definitely a sliding scale. And again, we're doing this every day, so that's our job to work through that with you. Also on our platform, when you list the property, you list how many parking spots are available, both street and off street, so that when people come in with a registered vehicle, it decrements each time someone takes one. So if you only have four parking spots and a fifth person comes in with a car, they wouldn't be able to view the property. So there's a mix of things. Sir? So minimum lease is 31 days. That is predominantly for legal reasons because it gets you out of any sort of short-term rental registration restrictions, that sort of thing, in almost every municipality. Our average stay is about 9.5 months. But the idea is you want it to be flexible because, one, the biggest failure mechanism is people being unable to pay. So it doesn't do you any good to say, hey, you can't pay. You need to stay here. No, you want that person to leave, obviously. But it's essentially people are paying by the week. It's long-term tenants. Ma'am.
Are there regulations about how many people can be living in a house that are not regulated?
Absolutely. The question is, sorry, I'm just getting a touch of water. The question was, are there regulations for how many people can live in a house? And the answer is, sure, it's real estate, it's hyper-local, so in Atlanta, there are 83 municipalities, which means there's 83 different regulations. We're in about 25 of those municipalities, and the way I would frame it is there's some municipalities where there really aren't regulations. So Houston is an example where we have a bunch of units. There's no zoning. You can kind of do whatever you want. It's amazing. You know, God bless Texas. It's great. There's other municipalities that have restrictions and are generally quite permissive. Atlanta being an example of that. You have other areas, many municipalities where it's gray area. You know, you may have a restriction against boarding houses, but boarding houses are defined as places that provide food, which we don't. So it's kind of, you know, it's a problem. And then there's other places where yes, you know, you can't do this. Period. Cobb County, Georgia. You know, so that's part of what our legal team helps folks out. There are definitely places where I wouldn't do this. There's other places where you could, but ought not. You know, for example, HOAs. I pretty much tell everyone, in theory, you could do it. I do. You know, we do not have the time or appetite to go through every set of bylaws in the country. You shouldn't operate in HOAs. I think you're setting yourself up for failure. But honestly, the thing that is, I mean, this happens everywhere, is one point. And really what it's about is doing it well. When we see properties fail, I'm going to get you in a second. I just want you to, like, get your arm tired. I'm a little verbose, so I'd spare you. You know, the code enforcement doesn't go around counting toothbrushes. It's not how this works. It's all bottom-up, right? So our residents are people. They're cut from the crooked timber that is humanity, and sometimes they fall short, and they park like jerks, right? They'll park in front of someone's mailbox or in front of someone's house, God forbid, or they'll, you know, a lot of people work night shift, and, you know, they're coming and going at weird hours, right? That's the nature of this demographic. And sometimes the neighbor across the street just doesn't like it, right, and they complain. Same thing, I mean, well, if the grass is cut, and the trash is being taken care of, and you're getting the right kind of asset, right, where you're not overtaxing local parking and you're close to public transit, or it's honestly a neighborhood where that's comfortable with renters, and we all know that there are neighborhoods that don't love rental properties. For anyone who's operated Section 8, you know those neighborhoods sometimes where it's legal, but, you know, neighbor across the street's going to complain, and what do passive-aggressive Americans do? They either put it on Nextdoor, which is new, or they call code enforcement. So that's why we're so involved up front to say, you know, for example, I talked to an investor last week who said, oh, I've got this house, I want to do it in Clearwater, Florida. And I'm like, I wouldn't, for the reasons being that, you know, regulatory / kind of neighbor expectations, the way the HOAs are set up there. So there's definitely, there's places where it works, essentially no matter what you do. There's places where it works if you're disciplined, and you should always be disciplined about how you operate. And there's places where you just ought to wave off. And again, we are very much incentivized to get you to wave off on those types of places. So you want to do it in Cobb County, Georgia? I would say good luck, but don't put that on me because I'll get too many nasty calls. Ma'am.
Two questions. So, is that on your roadmap?
Yes, ma'am.
And the second question is, like, general cleaning, like cleaning of bathrooms and kitchens and things like that.
Perfect, yep. Perfect, great question. So it's a mix. Most cleaning tasks have to be on the residents, right? There's no way that you can have a cleaning service that will clean quickly enough. I'm a lapsed management consultant, I'm ashamed to admit. I think of everything in a 2x2 matrix. I can't get away from it. The way that we think about it is, again, almost everything has to be done by the residents. So think of, we're really getting in the weeds, but that's okay. Think of every cleaning task as either individually caused or group caused, and then urgent or non-urgent. So what residents have to do is everything that is not non-urgent and group caused. So the way to think about it is dishes, right? We have a policy called Sink Zero. Everything has to be out of the sink, right? We literally hang posters on the walls that say Sink Zero. And the reason for that is you can't wait for a cleaning lady to take over to clean the dishes, right? It's your dish, it's individual, and it's urgent, right? If you don't clean it up, it'll get bugs, it'll get gross, and then it'll kind of pile up. Your dish, you got to clean it up. Do your dishes, we're not your mom. Urgent, group is like taking out the trash, right? Trash has to be taken out every week. Is it my trash? Is it your trash? It's our trash. Someone's got to take out the trash. And we have, it's not a chore wheel. I keep being corrected on it. It's more like a chore checklist brag sheet. Anyway, within our product to get the residents doing that kind of thing and notifications within the product to say, hey, it's trash day. Take out the trash, you know, so on. And then cleaning, essentially what a cleaning service hired by the host should do is non-urgent, clutch things like wiping down toilets once a month, mopping down common areas. So that's kind of the balance, sir.
First of all, what is the smallest bedroom size you have, and does each tenant typically have a microfig fridge in their room?
Great question. So the smallest bedroom size is determined by local building code. Generally, that's either 70 or 80 square feet with no less than 7 feet in any direction and at least 7 feet ceiling height. Two modes of egress. So a door and a window that meets egress standards. Again, it's depending on local building code, but almost everywhere uses IRC. So it's local building code. Needs to meet normal habitability standards. And then as far as the most rooms do not have mini fridges or microwaves. Some do. That is an owner decision. It's part of the listing. You know, you are allowed to put them in there. We're more of a recommendation than a requirements-based company, so I would recommend if you have, say, more than 7 bedrooms, to put a second fridge, maybe in the laundry room or something like that. And some people will say, hey, you know, I'm going to put in a mini fridge and I'm going to charge more. That's fine, too. You mark it off on the platform. That's great, but it's not required or anything like that. Ma'am. So again, it depends a little bit on local building code. There are places where you cannot do that at all. We are lock agnostic. What I generally recommend is actually privacy locks with a door chain. And it's a little bit counterintuitive. And some folks prefer to do mechanical punch pads. I would strongly recommend against keyed locks. And the reason for that is that people lock their key in their room. Actually, sort of as an aside, when we got into this business, if you look at traditional rooming houses, and again, traditional rooming houses are oftentimes pretty scummy places, but they serve a market need, which is why they exist. I'll lug in here. They oftentimes have deadbolts, and we're like, oh, that's against code in many places because firefighters can't get in, and it's dangerous. But, you know, so we would sort of scoff at these slumlords with these deadbolts. So we put in these key locks. We thought, oh, it's safer. You know, we're good people. And this is going to give everyone a seizure, so I may just pipe it down. So I apologize. But actually, those rooming house operators were smart because you can't lock your key inside a room with a deadbolt because you need the key to turn a lock. Whereas with a keyed lock, people do it all the time and almost always on a Friday night at like midnight. And then, you know, it's some guys like, oh, I came home from work, I showered, they're in a towel. and they're waiting, you know, until when to get, you know, sleeping in their car. Like, it's bad, so key lock's bad. The mechanical punch pad locks, some people love them. I tend to think they're a little finicky for most maintenance staff. So it's a personal choice. I can talk for hours about the pros and cons of locks in a way that will make everybody leave. So I won't begrudge you, sir. TVs, not provided by the landlord. Some folks do bring their own TVs, but generally I would say just to not do it. I want to quick, because this is going into seizure mode, so we'll kind of like briefly put it. Nia said something really interesting earlier. She said, oh, you know, blah, 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 I don't want to manage tenants. Look, I get it, right? I have a job. I have three kids. Management is a lot of work. Now, we can refer property managers in any market we're in who we've trained and have worked with. We have a vendor program. However, we are doing a new pilot offering where we are allowing, we are selling turnkey properties to investors. Again, it's in the markets we're in, so really you're thinking Dallas, Houston, Jacksonville, Atlanta. We'll do Tampa in the next month or two. But where investors are coming to us, they're buying a fully vetted passport property purchased, underwritten by our sidecar fund. And then, so we're sourcing it. We're managing the renovation. We're providing turnkey property management, everything. You can get a package, but you don't have to buy it. You know, you're just buying it from us. We're managing it. We're providing financing for the property, and we just send you money every month. So that is a new pilot offering for those of you who think this is great, love it, and I'm not going to really do much to do it, but I want to get involved. It's actually not on our website. This is the good news is if you are interested in this, because it's not on our website because it's not public, you can come visit our booth, which is out there, and talk to me. You can go to passport.com/hosts and create an account. I'm going to shut this down because people are going to yell at me about it. But just at the very end, but that's okay. We were wrapped up anyway. But yes, you can talk to me personally. We can get you on that list. It's a bespoke offering and not open to the public. We're actually rolling it out here at OREA for the first time. So again, I put down the slides because it was driving everyone crazy. I'm happy to answer more questions, ma'am.
Right. So my husband has been balking privately on this business model. Mm-hmm. We have so many clients that are doing this, and they work directly with you if they have a problem.
Yep.
Their office, they have great reviews. Mm-hmm. Great.
I pay Daryl a lot of money for those reviews, though.
Data are just kicking it, right?
That's true. Okay. Where in Cobb County? Okay. Yeah. I'm in which county?
In Bartow County, B-A-R-T-O-W, Bartow County, so we're in Cartersville.
Okay, yep.
Are you working at all in that area?
The closest we are to there is Acworth. We will have some going in Rome, Georgia, within the next couple months, but... Yeah. Georgia has an insane number of counties, so it's totally impossible for me to keep track. But yes, I think it's 159, so it's insane. But got it.
If I want to drop two of our properties in your platform, mm-hmm. can I contact you?
Yep.
About
absolutely.
Getting into that and any kind of advice you can give about working with the county or the city?
So, in general, I mean, we would want to do a quick look at the local code, which wouldn't take long. You know, be fine. We could do it during this week. You know, during this weekend, that's fine. For the most part, we'd actually really want to look at the assets themselves and to say, hey, you know, I mean, we just have a different way of looking at the property in terms of privacy from neighbors, that kind of thing, parking, and so we should do that at the asset level. But happy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's the same way my husband is.
Sure.
He does not want to have the hassle of it. But Carrie, Daryl, everybody's saying, Lisa, anyway, they're all of them saying that you guys screen the tenants so
earlier. I'm asking the same question all the time. Now, I appreciate their kind words. I wouldn't say it's perfect, honestly. I mean, dealing with tenants is a job. Now, we like to think we lean in hard on it for certainly the interpersonal stuff. We do all the collections, that kind of thing. The hope is that it comes down to essentially being proactive and reactive maintenance, which for the most part doesn't vary that much having more people. You tend to have more of a dull roar of work orders because you've got the room turns that happen every other month or so, fine. And look, if you have six people in a house, no one lets anything slide, right? You got a slow drip. Five people walk past it, fine. That sixth person is like, I need someone out here. The good of that is you don't have the deferred maintenance where, in normal properties, where the slow drip lasts for, a year and a half, and then, like, why do you say anything? It's like, I don't like making phone calls. So we have spies in the house. So it's a mix. And look, and Daryl was our first host doing this model where he's managing it. And, it's been a work in progress, where people will submit a maintenance ticket saying, hey, like, I'm going to pay on Thursday. And he's like, what am I supposed to do with this? I'm like, I'll just ignore it, So it takes a bit of healthy cheer to, get through it. But we are, obviously, our goal is to make it manageable. Ma'am?
Can you help determine what the right price is?
We do. So we have a pricing tool on our site as you're listing the property that pulls in public data, zip code, what kind, is it private bath versus shared? You can do whatever you want. So it's, if it says, oh, it should be $145 a week, and you say, oh, actually, I think it should be $150 or $130, whatever, that's fine. But so we do a recommendation, but you can, free country, you can do whatever you want. Sir? Yeah, about 90%. Yes, sir. Great question. So if you think about traditional property management, they're doing lease up, collections, proactive and reactive maintenance, kind of the full stack. We do lease up and collections, but what we don't do is proactive and reactive maintenance. So property managers, you need a property manager for the property. Now, we have people we can refer in certain markets. So, for example, in Atlanta or for this turnkey offering, we provide that property management. Again, we sort of outsource it, but we kind of take care of all that. Some property managers love working with Padsplit because they don't have to deal with collections and lease up. Others get paid for each lease up, so they hate working with Padsplit. So that it depends on their monetization model. But in general, we do the lease up and collections and kind of people management side of property management, and the property managers mostly does the maintenance side of property management.
Have you had other customers of yours negotiate with the property managers?
Totally. So some property managers...
Obviously, that's the majority of the job.
Exactly. Right. And the thing about property management is they need to work for the property owner. They are your agent. So a lot of times people say, I'd like for Padsplit to manage my property. I'm like, do you really? Because we work for Padsplit. That's the way we work. We also have our other customers, which are the residents. You want a property manager who will say no sometimes on maintenance and say, oh, actually, we're not going to fix this, or we're not going to provide this or that. They work for you. Certainly we've been asked by property managers, and that's part of our onboarding and training process to say, and we do train property managers, so if you've got a property manager in Cincinnati, then come to our program, we do training for them to talk through how to use our platform and room turns and think through that, but the way that they charge is kind of up to them because they're their own businesses and they've got their own processes. Some people do flat fee and then plus cost. Some people do a percentage of revenue. We don't really care. Think of it as like Airbnb superhosts, right? Different ways that they monetize it. We've had people do profit shares. That's fine. It's a little complicated. It's not how I would run it, but it all depends on the property manager. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. property, and my VA called on November 1st when I was traveling, so I only found out that yesterday, and yesterday I have the PI sheet, you know, after their call, but I didn't bring it today. I wonder, do you have a time to, you know, put it on there and walk us through the things? Because I haven't buy it. If they agree to have a turn, not just to buy cash. And 13 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. So, this kind of property.
13-2.
Turing has some famous university and the hospital.
Sure. So, where's the property?
Durant.
Okay, got it. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'd swing by our booth. We can go through it in depth. So, yeah, this is... I like talking at the asset level. That's kind of where I like to be. So, yeah, happy to do that. We're kind of right around the corner. Big pad split sign. Sir?
You may already talk about this. I apologize.
It's good. Sure. For the rooms, or well, we'll go through it. So the room prices are, we do recommendations, but set it wherever you want. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 12% of revenue. That's it. Yeah, so we stole from Airbnb. We steal a lot of stuff from Airbnb. That's why we call the property owners hosts. That's why our website looks like it does. We do blue instead of red. But yeah, we their SEC filing, thank you, was they take 13.8%. We were like, pretty close to 12. Fine. Ma'am?
Exclusively.
Yep. So, so you can put whatever kind of bed you want. It's part of the listing. Most people do full. That's generally my kind of standard recommendation. Now, it could be because I think twin beds are a little shorter, and I hate twin beds, and I went to the Naval Academy, and they have all twin beds, and I'm not that tall, but my feet were hanging off the edge, so we may be reflecting my personal bias a little bit, but I like full because it kind of discourages friends, it's still big enough for, you know, normal, like, sized people, I guess. We have had people put king beds in rooms because they just own king beds. I think it's crazy, but it's just part of the listing, and you can kind of do whatever you want. Sir? So, great question. We strongly discourage pets in every form or fashion. Depending on the local municipality, you are oftentimes required to accept registered service animals, which does not include emotional support animals. We've been through this many times with folks, but yes, in some cases you are. We make it at least hard for folks because, and I mean, it's honestly, part of it's just that I don't think it's appropriate for a co-living environment. Like, we are not an all things to all people kind of company. Right kind of asset, right kind of investor, right kind of resident. So couples and but I have kids, I may be a monster, but it's not because of having kids. But it's not appropriate for a co-living environment, right? We had previously accepted kind of single children or single parent, single child, and eventually came to the conclusion that it just wasn't appropriate, too much risk. Not to say it's never happened. I mean, sometimes people have booked and then magically show up with a child, and then we kind of have to go through that process on our end. But for us, it's singles. And I feel the same way about pets. Again, you know, pets, like dogs, you know, it's fine, but not great for a co-living environment with people with allergies and that kind of thing. So same thing, we get the question about ADA compliance. Almost all these properties are single-family zoned. You're not required to be ADA compliant in these single-family neighborhoods, in part because it's not appropriate for every house to be ADA compliant. You can't kind of backfit it. So we're more focused on being kind of right fit. So I think we do have a service animal out of 2,900 units, but we try to make it not easy. Sir?
Your niche is in bigger cities and closer to downtown. Yes?
So not necessarily closer to downtown, but certainly metro areas, I think, is probably an accurate way. I mean, we're in Richmond, Virginia. We're in Valdosta, Georgia. I mean, I don't consider those big cities, but sure.
The outer line towns and so forth, it doesn't do nearly as well.
It depends a little bit. I mean, anywhere in sort of the city or kind of suburbs, is right down the middle for us, fine. In Atlanta Metro, we're in 15 different counties. Some of those you would not consider urban. You know, Jackson County is actually where Darrell owns one of his properties. I'm not really a city boy. I definitely consider that the country. But it's near a big, like, manufacturing distribution center, so it's filled up and it's done really well. There are other places in that county where I would say, Darrell, like, you're crazy. But this one that's right by a big kind of facility with 1,000 workers who are right in the demographic has cooked. And also is big and has plenty of parking, doesn't really have neighbors, you know, it's great. So there's a slightly different lens through which you'd look at the properties, but we're in exurbs. I mean, we're going to Rome, Georgia. Rome, Georgia is not city, you know. It's not like Rome, Italy. Ma'am.
Good question. Mm-hmm. What do you do if somebody doesn't pay their weekly payment? How quickly do you get
We have this cousin of mine from South Jersey with no neck. No, I'm just kidding. I have many of those Italian cousins there. They're all about this tall, though, unfortunately. So they're not too scary. So again, we run the collections process. It can be complicated. Obviously, the eviction moratorium is not super helpful to this or maybe anything. So what we do is we have a, you know, if people fall enough behind, which is, call it effectively 2 weeks worth, right? And it's kind of a point where our research shows that you're better off moving on to the next person than trying to collect. So either way, it's about revenue optimization. But let's say I fall behind, $300, okay, I don't make the payment during the time that I have to. We have what we call the easy way, hard way conversation with that resident and say, look, you know, we're all adults here. Door one, shake hands as friends, no big deal. You got to go. You need an extra 24 hours, 48 hours. That's fine. PadSplit has services they can refer you to. You know, it'll all be fine. No collections agency is going to chase you. If you want to come back, you have to pay down this debt. You know, you want to come back in 6 months, that's fine. But you can go, part as friends, no judgment, nothing in the courts, no big deal. Won't hit your, it won't follow you. Or file for dispossessory. Again, part of the reason we're in sort of the markets we're in Georgia and Texas and Florida and Virginia and Louisiana. We're going to file, we're going to win, and it's not going to take that long. And we have an eviction service provider that's national that we kind of handle through that process through. So we're going to do it, going to win, going to get a judgment with back pay. And look, you may never pay it, but every time you get a job, our hand's going to be out. It will go to a collections agency. You will have a dispossessory on your record. Every time you apply for an apartment, it's going to be there, and they're going to see it, and they're not going to like it. So, hey, like, choose, and we're kind of cool either way. And most people are pretty damn pragmatic, right? Not everyone. Some people, they love the hard way, right? And so, look, formal evictions are part of the business. It happens. It's relatively rare, but if you think that you'll never have an eviction, it's not true necessarily. If you're doing enough, you will have a formal eviction eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So everybody has their own room. Mm-hmm. The only common place then is the kitchen and shared bathrooms.
That's right. I mean, it depends a little bit on the houses, but yeah, in general.
Converting your dining room, your living room into bedrooms.
Exactly. And even if you have a living room, like sometimes you can't convert a space to a bedroom, it just doesn't fit or isn't big enough. We don't like living room. We have a motto, bad things happen on couches, right? You know, and you can only learn these lessons the hard way, but you think about it, you know, we're male, female, you know, it's mixed. It's, average age of resident is about 38, but again, it's 20 through 65, you know, mixed ages. You know, a woman comes back from work, takes the bus, comes back at night. What's happening on the couch, right? People fighting over the remote, people eating food on soft surfaces, someone letting their friend crash, people making babies. It's all bad, right? Bad things happen on couches. So no couches, right? I'm sort of a fanatic about it. And we've all made this mistake as investors, right? You think of your rental property is like your property where you live, and it's not. So, I mean, I go into a property, and you're like, oh, like, why do you have a bookshelf? And I'm like, oh, I like books. I'm like, fantastic, I like books. Like, get that thing out of there, because you stick your hand behind a bookshelf, and you get the Snickers wrapper and dust, and it's like bookshelf in your own house. Rental property should be kind of like fast food restaurants, hard surfaces, easy to bleach, easy to clean. Like, certainly pad splits. You don't want to be too comfortable in a common area. You don't want to sleep in the common area. Like, so, okay, you can have a dining area. It's more respectful posture. No one will make babies on the table usually, you know, hopefully. So, yeah, it's definitely, you try and control the space in that way. I think your question.
What's your policy for them having visitors? I assume no overnight visitors, but can they have a friend over?
Friends during the day. We have essentially hours for it. And essentially, our view is it's actually referred to as the Frank policy at work because I invented it. But our view is we want, the way I always thought of it is kind of want it to be like a sorority in that. This stuff's going to happen, right? Everyone knows it's going to happen. It's not, you don't beat biology. Like, that's just not going to happen. But you want people to be mindful of their pad mates. So they're the people who are going to report it, right? Like, no one from Padsplit is going to camp out in this room and, like, wait for people to come back. So we know it's going to happen. But we want people to be like a sorority where it's like, look, you can come in, but you're sneaking out in the morning, you're going to be quiet, and, like, you're out of here. You're not using the shower. Like, you're not using the kitchen. Like, get out. Because they're being respectful to their roommates. And they're being so respectful of their roommates that they're like, oh, yeah, that person had a guest overnight, but whatever. They were gone in the morning, and they didn't use the laundry or whatever. Like, that's fine. We'll never know about it, and we won't care. And that's, so, yes, we have a rule, no overnight guests. I am enough of a believer in human nature that I'm sure it is abused. But it is. But the idea is, yes, it is a rule, and if it's a problem with the padmates, then it's a problem with us. But yeah, absolutely. Guests during the day, during certain hours, quiet hours at night. No guests overnight. Ma'am.
Do you require or recommend security cameras on the front level?
So I think outdoor cameras are fine. It's really an investor decision. Some people have tried to do interior cameras. I hate interior cameras. I think it doesn't really work. It drives you crazy. It makes people angry. In common areas, so it's but some people have used, you know, Nest cams and outside and or Ring cams and they're fine.
Yeah.
So regular laundry generally, probably personal bias. I've never really liked coin laundry. I know they're not really coin anymore and they've got the cards, but so I may be dated in my experience, but my view is the companies that do coin laundry, they like multifamily because they get a ton of throughput and everyone's happy. You talk to them, at least the providers we've talked to around the markets we're in, they're kind of like, you want me to put laundry and pay for it and put it in a house, like a single-family house? Like, not super excited about it. So maybe it's just that I deal with jerk vendors and you work with much nicer ones, but I generally think that, you know, you spend a couple $100 on a washer dryer, you don't think about it, and you bake it into the price is easier than dealing with another vendor. But I'm also a lazy person who doesn't like dealing with a lot of stuff. Ma'am. So the question was, how do they collect the rent? So everything's electronic and paid through our platform. So it's credit, debit, ACH, all through our platform. Or, you know, they're on their app.
It's automatically coming out.
So we do have an auto pay option that is the default. People do deselect the auto pay option, but because this is a very tight cash flow kind of demographic, so sometimes people will kind of pay as they go. But we automate the late fees and all that. But yes, it's all electronic. We don't do kind of cash or money order, check anything, sir. So we don't do a security deposit. There are legal reasons why. What we do is a non-refundable move-in fee. So it defaults $100. You can kind of set it wherever you want. And the idea is it's meant to pay for the eventual room turn, plus, you know, a little bit more. But you get paid when they move in, right, or whenever your first payment comes. But they pay it to move in, and it's yours. You don't have to put an escrow. You don't have to fiddle with it. It's yours to keep. And You never give it back. But yeah, we do a move-in fee, but it's smaller. Part of our value proposition to the renters is, you know, if you want to get an apartment, even a $1,000 a month apartment that's not super fancy, a lot of places, especially if you're relatively thin file on credit, you have to do first and last month's rent, maybe a double security deposit, and you have to do turn on your utilities. Oftentimes there's a deposit, for power or water. So you might be $3,000 in to get an apartment, and as everyone knows, a lot of Americans do not have $3,000 in savings. Like they just don't. So, again, even people who could afford the rent for a Class C apartment oftentimes cannot actually clear that barrier to entry. Whereas for us, you do a $100 move-in fee, you do your first week, the utilities are baked into that price, you aren't paying deposits to turn that stuff on. Hey, it's $250 to move in. That's a much more manageable hurdle to jump through. Ma'am. So we don't model that after Airbnb. No. So we do have some mechanisms for if a member damages a room on their way out. So we don't do it for collections. In part, we actually did a trial with that. We found that too many people were in cahoots because the people are still there. And, we essentially have people cutting side deals, saying like, hey, you're living in my house. Passport's going to cover it if you don't pay. So just pay me cash, and then they'll pay me too. So we don't do that, fool me once. If someone damages the room, the move-in fee is also, intended to pay for part of that as well, but we can kind of cover some of that as well. But what's different with us in Airbnb, and I mean, there's many, also our valuation, I'm not a billionaire. That's the more unfortunate piece of what we're not like Airbnb. But these are long-term tenants. So Airbnb, you get someone in, they stay, and if they damage your property, I mean, it's all prepay, obviously, for Airbnb. So they don't do collections. It's you pay, and that's that. But someone comes in and damages your house, right, and they cause $5,000 worth of damage. Airbnb is their guarantee policy, but they're out, right? You don't file for it when they're there. For us, the people are there, right? So there's kind of that initial step to say, but it's fine when someone leaves to say, they damaged this wall, like, let's talk about that. But you can't say, hey, these people are there. I want them to be there and keep paying, but I want Passport to cover this and that. We just found it was too complicated while people are still living in the house. And, it's like, if you want someone to go, like, let's talk about how you can get someone to go. But maintenance of the house is still the owner's responsibility, and that's part of being a landlord. Yeah. Got it. Great question. So they pay up front to move in, and then it's essentially pay as you go from there. It's like an evergreen agreement. So then they're paying weekly. Always in advance. Yes, ma'am. Exactly. Yeah, but it's weekly. So yeah, and so we're right. Sure. I mean, if they stop paying, if they're paying on time every time, they never hear from us, everyone's happy. If they stop paying, we have a whole team of pests who just hound these people. It's not me. I'm way too, I can't get it done. But these people, they're on top of it. So they're hounding these people, call, text, email, chasing them, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, if they're not paying, yeah, we're on them. And if they continue to not pay for long enough, then it kind of begins this termination procedures. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Yeah.
And then they all have
to pay for those. That's right. Yeah. Sir.
If, let's say there's six people in the house,
mm-hmm.
and there's a troublemaker,
mm-hmm.
can the other five vote
them off the island?
Okay.
So it isn't quite that simple, but yes, they, it isn't a vote per se, but we do, we have kind of this three-key system, and they can remove the keys, and it's sort of adjudicated by our customer support team. So if there's one troublemaker and five people don't like this person, it will eventually come to either termination or transfer. Ma'am. Oh. Exactly. Yeah, so now we call it three keys, and they go down from 3 to 1. That's the exact same thing. That's pretty much how it works. So you can have keys removed, less for payment issues. I mean, the collections ones are very more straightforward. But so if someone, you know, smokes in the house, right, it's against the rules, you know, this or that, if they get down to zero, their membership is terminated, as we say.
Yeah. So are you getting, like, in these splits?
Absolutely not. Almost the exact opposite. So, a lot of people come in and say, oh, you know, how do I, like, I'm going to bake in utilities. How do I even do that? What I recommend is using central HVAC, having a smart thermostat, and locking it with a pin, right? And saying, hey, it's heats to 68, cools to 76. Or wherever you think is appropriate for your climate, you lock it, and the idea is you do not want, if you control your HVAC, you're controlling 70% of your energy spend. And so thinking up front when you're setting up the property to reduce your utility spend as much as possible. So again, and people are going to take long showers. You know, I'm a married man. This may or may not happen in my house occasionally. I have a daughter. This stuff happens. But you put in a low-flow shower head, and you control it that way as much as you can. So if you control HVAC, you have low-flow fixtures, your utility spend is pretty manageable. But, yeah, absolutely not. If you have people control their own temperature, it's like you'll have 85 in the winter and 58. You'll freeze things. It's not good. Yeah. No, it's pay-as-you-go. Did you have a question?
What, so is a C neighborhood good for this, or B neighborhood, or?
So generally, yeah, I mean, generally you're seeing C neighborhoods. We have a spread, and we're agnostic in terms, I mean, it's mostly that the economics point you towards kind of C neighborhoods. Oftentimes people come to us and say, oh, you know, love what you're doing. I've got this condo in Buckhead. You know, you use your technology and all affordable housing and all, you know, I'll get a great yield. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you won't get more yields. Like, the, you know, so our view is people, you know, if you think about if you're buying a house in a certain city, right, you may have inexpensive houses, and you have a $10 million house, you have an enormous spread. Renting is more compressed. You know, you might have relatively inexpensive and expensive rentals. Renting rooms is even more compressed, right, because you're ultimately, like, the rooms are more similar. So people might pay a little bit more to be in a really nice neighborhood, but they're not paying double, and they're certainly not paying 10x the way you might if you're buying. So it's you still want to have a neighborhood that's safe enough that you feel like you want to own in and that kind of thing. I mean, I've had people say, I mean, I live in Atlanta. We have some tough neighborhoods in Atlanta. And sometimes people say, oh, what do you think about this street? I'm like, God, that street, you're going to send a plumber there on a Friday night? Like, you're going to check that out for me? If I'm like, oh, would I come here with my kids, you know, on a Saturday? Or would I be like, I can't unlock the doors? Like, would I feel safe sending a plumber there? You know, that's kind of my standard. So you don't want to be in the worst neighborhoods, but the best neighborhoods, honestly, you're going to be priced out. You'll be relatively low yield, and you won't get paid for it.
And then you had mentioned that you don't take ESAs. Mm-hmm. How do you not run afoul of fair housing with that?
And when you said ESAs, I'm not even familiar. So you're actually not required to accept emotional support animals. There's no legal designation for them. That's a fake thing. So it's that does not exist in ADA. It does not exist in fair housing.
Well, I wonder if it's our local municipality that's...
Could be, but it is not. Yeah, emotional support animal is a... Like, sometimes people have a card, and I'm like, congratulations for your card. Doesn't mean anything. It's not a... That's not a legal designation.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sir? So, admittedly, we're mostly in these balmy southern climes. Now, that being said, plenty of people think it gets too cold in Georgia, too. Our baseline rules, which hosts can amend, but our base rules, default rules, forbid space heaters. And that's more for safety reasons. They're also incredibly energy inefficient. You pay for it. But second leading cause of fires or deaths by fires in rental properties is from space heaters. Obviously, smoking is number one. So, again, and smoking is another one of our default rules. In theory, you could delete that rule. I would tell you you're crazy and it's a dumb idea. But, you know, there are plenty of things that are dumb but legal. You know, that's fine. But, yeah, space heaters are... our default rule is forbidden, and I would strongly recommend keeping them forbidden. Doesn't mean it never happens, but it's definitely like a problem. Ma'am.
Can you self-manage?
Absolutely. People do it all the time.
I have. I've done this a few times in a neighborhood close to the airport in Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and it worked out well.
Yep.
The males were in a and they graduated from college and worked at a local engineering company before they got transferred and worked out right. Then I started dealing with agencies, and you don't know the special needs, and that did not work out well.
Yep.
But I find males, all males work out, because they are, factory workers or this or that. And then I had a group of flight attendants in the second floor apartment that did this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I need to be doing this.
Yep. Great. Ma'am.
What mid-20s pieces house hacking.
And okay.
She has a second floor bedroom that has a living area for herself.
Okay.
She stays upstairs, has a main fridge. Everybody else shares a downstairs. She does cook and use the downstairs food. But she has three guys, and they were college friends.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has a girlfriend.
Trouble.
So she had to play hardball with him, and he was like, oh, well, it's not a problem to anybody else. And he was kind of stressing the other way down to not speak up.
Right.
So he ended up realizing the grass is greener on the other side. He had no damn money. He had a lot of stuff that he stored in the basement, and he didn't realize that he can't just move somewhere else for $600 a month.
Sure.
In a nice residential area. And he came back crawling with one of these, saying, I'm really she won't stay overnight with him once a week.
Exactly, yeah. It's and that's great. I'm glad.
She had to deal with it. She didn't expect that to happen. I'm like, they're all guys.
Men are awful. Not all men are awful, but men are awful. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, sink zero.
She's always had issues with things, but now we're better.
Good, good.
The agencies call this SRO, so single worker agency. And I found, because I've worked with a lot of agencies, that their funding has changed recently. They used to put the special needs client account in their own apartments, but there's not enough housing.
Yep.
So I actually have like an 8-bedroom house that wasn't personal care, and I rent it to an agency, and they bring the people in.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm in a legal battle with the township because they were the press people in.
Yep.
And the name of complaint.
Yep.
Now they're saying I didn't fill out zoning right. What am I running?
Yeah, it can be tricky, certainly in municipalities, and we've struggled similarly with various nonprofits and city agencies for the exact same reasons. And unfortunately, there is a big need in that space. We're not perfect for it because it takes a lot of support services for a lot of these folks. So there's a housing continuum that runs from homelessness to I don't know, having a mansion or something, owning your own home outright, I guess, but. We're obviously on the lower end of the continuum, below having your own apartment, but certainly above kind of the supportive housing, shelters, that kind of thing. And for us, it's a matter of saying, got it, because sometimes it obviously comes with payments, right? And which, you know, I'm like anyone else. I'm like, oh, you'll guarantee payments for X months? Like, let's have a conversation. But we've kind of struggled with it, obviously over-indexed on mental health issues and that kind of thing, which is tricky. And we're just not the right spot for people. And I feel the same way with, single parents with a child. You know, obviously there's a huge need out there. We've done the same thing with VASH vouchers for veterans, where we've done some limited work there, but for certain people who really need a lot of help, this isn't the right environment, and it isn't fair to them, and it isn't fair to the other people in the house. So yeah, it's can't be all things to all people, unfortunately. I'm getting the wave on minutes, so I think I'm pretty much out. I'm here all week, I guess all weekend. Our booth is kind of around the corner. I'm easy to find. I'm Frank at padsplit.com. I'm the only Frank. I'm easy to find. I'm here. My colleagues are also here. They Blake and Ray are kind of manning the booth or peopling the booth or whatever such people do. Love to have you come over and chat. But thank you so much for your time.